Good afternoon, everybody. This is John Javelin from the FIA Group, welcoming you to our monthly webinar, A Call to Action, Proposed State and Federal Regulations, Bulletins, Litigation, Industry Developments, and Troubling Trends. Thanks so much, as always, for joining us this month.
Hey, John, hold on.
Yeah.
Folks, I apologize, John. I don't know what John was thinking that he could take over the first slide.
Yeah.
Even though I'm in Phoenix, Arizona, where I've been for the past couple weeks. John, nice try, but I'm going to make sure
you.
I finish this first slide off. Hi, everybody. It's Adam Russo, the co-founder and CEO of the FIA Group, welcoming all of you to another webinar. We're really excited about this opportunity to share with you what's really happening on both the state and federal level as it relates to the self-insured industry. In order to prepare for us for this particular webinar, we actually reached out and have been discussions with all the major associations and industry organizations to find out what's really on their radar, what are the issues they're working on. And based on all that feedback, Ron, Chris, John, and myself have put this webinar together. Speaking of Ron, for those of you who don't know, Ron had a baby boy. What was that, 2 days ago, guys?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, he had a healthy baby boy about 2 days ago. So he is on, I guess, paternity leave, I think, for the next 2 days. That's all I gave him off. So he'll be back. He'll be back pretty soon. In addition, just so you know, for those who don't know, I also had twins last week on Tuesday, a boy and a girl. So this webinar had a baby boom over the past week with my two kids. Ron had a baby. So now I guess we're just waiting for Chris and John to have some kids as well before the next
one. Not week. Together, but you'll be waiting a long time.
All right, so with me, as usual, is Chris Aguiar. He'll have hit more than one slide today because he has to fill in for Ron. We also have John Javelin, our legal counsel, here as well, as usual. And we have a new, very special guest today, as many of you may know, Tim Callender, who is a well-respected attorney in the self-insured fields, who's been working in our industry for many, many years, has joined FIA officially as of Monday. We actually put that in Ernie Clevers' newsletter over the weekend. So, Tim, maybe you want to say hi to the fine folks that are listening in?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Adam. Yeah, it's outstanding. I know I've met a lot of you, done, you know, plenty of webinars in my own right back in the day, and now I am just extremely excited to be part of FIA. I'm passionate about this industry and what we do, and I couldn't think of a better place to be to continue serving this industry. For those of you that I haven't met, I look forward to meeting you, whether it's, you know, over the phone or on the circuit as we're chatting at conferences. But yeah, this is a great place to be. Obviously, I'm from Idaho, and so I flew out to my very first ever visit to Boston this last weekend, and then here I am enjoying it this week, and things are going great. So happy to be here today, and thanks, Adam, for the intro.
No problem, and, you know, he's our live studio audience guest today, so it's pretty cool. He gets to actually see the insides of what happens during our webinars. So anyways, as usual, if you have any questions, please type them in. If we have time at the end, we will make sure we respond back to you as well. So with that, let's get on with the presentation and what we want to go over. So, overview. These are the three elements that we want to make sure we discuss. Costs. What do you care about? I've been having a lot of presentations and discussions with various entities all across the country, and this one area resonates with a lot of people because it really talks about the overall issue that we have as an industry, and it relates to the cost of actual health care. So we want to make sure we touch on that. Then we will also touch base in regards to the legal and regulatory developments that we've seen across the country from both an industry level and also just from working on cases. Last but not least, we will dive into troubling trends that we've seen across the industry as well. But again, if what you're going to notice, the theme of this is everything from a legal and regulatory standpoint and the trends that we're seeing across the country, all of it really stems back to the problem with the cost and how the what people actually care about as it relates to cost within the healthcare market is very different. And it really is what causes most of the issues that we're seeing across our country today. So speaking of that, what do these separate entities worry about? So when I go buy a car, it's pretty obvious that when I'm purchasing a car, one of the things that I obviously care about is the quality, obviously, but I'm also caring about the cost. So in our industry, the members, they're the ones who are purchasing the car. They're the ones who will be driving the car. They are the consumer. So at the end of the day, what do members, your patients, your plan members, actually care about when it comes to the cost of care? When I ask people this all across the country, I always get the wrong answer. And then you'll have this one guy in the back who actually says the right thing. And what it is, it's the copay and deductible. That, at the end of the day, folks, is the problem that we have in our industry. The members, the people who actually get the care, they don't actually care about the entire bill. All they care about is their out-of-pocket. So whether they go to a $70,000 claim or a $400,000 claim, at the end of the day, that patient's worried about what is my copay, what is my out-of-pocket, what is my deductible. I have a sister-in-law who is a union glazer, which means she actually goes up on skyscrapers and installs windows. Okay, so she probably weighs 80 pounds, but that's what she does for a living. And when they wanted to increase their copay from $5 to $10, they wanted to go on strike. Because that's all they care about, is the out-of-pockets, copays, deductibles. And our health insurance providers, the facilities, et cetera, they're aware of that. Now, so I hear plans and PTAs always complaining that the members don't care about the bill. They don't have any skin in the game. But at the end of the day, what do plans really care about? Well, here's the answer. What plans really care about, coming down to it, is what they're paying up to the spec limit, their dollar exposure. So I've been on thousands of calls, I'm guessing, over the years, where I'm on the phone with the broker, the plan, the TPA, and you know, everyone else. And while I'm on the phone, I realize one thing, that the plan, when there's a $400,000 bill, isn't worried about the whole bill. What they'll say to me is, well, thankfully, we purchased stop loss. So we're only on the hook for the first $30,000 anyways. We're only on the hook for the first $50,000 anyways. The plan doesn't care about the entire bill because that's why they purchased stop loss. Even the stop loss marketing materials that are out there particularly discuss the fact that you can limit your exposure. You don't have to worry about the large dollar claim. That's why you have stop loss coverage. So the entities involved, the stop loss carrier themselves, and the plan themselves have different things that they actually care about. The plan is also not worried about the whole bill. So what does stop loss carrier care about? I think I pretty much answered my own question, the whole bill. So you have a stop loss when there's a $2 million bill and the spec's $50,000. That plan is going, woo, thank God we purchased stop loss and my exposure's at $50,000. They're not really worried about how to take that $2 million claim and knock it down to $1 million. How to take a $2 million claim and have the right to audit it, even though it's a network claim. In their mind, they have protection. They bought insurance. The problem that we have is the only entity in the healthcare market that actually cares about the healthcare bill does everything possible to ensure that the industry does not look at a stop loss carrier as a health plan. So the only entity that cares about a healthcare bill goes out of its way to make sure it's not viewed as a healthcare plan or a health insurance company, because it's not. And this fundamentally is the problem, is that there is not the members, the plans, the TPAs, and the stop loss carriers. None of these four entities, I didn't even include TPAs on here, but it's pretty much tied into what the plans care about. None of these entities have the same concern when it comes to the overall cost of care. What do the brokers care about? I'll hear, oh, they care about their, you know, they care about their commission. Well, yeah, but unless they keep the plan happy, there is no commission. So the problem that we have is in the brokerage world, they look at everything as a short-term solution. So when a plan has a $1 million claim, and I know I can negotiate that claim and get it paid at $200,000 if I just had another week, but that plan is complaining that the member's being balanced billed or there's some noise, and they just want to, quote-unquote, get the claim paid. The broker's sitting there going, I want my plan to be happy. If my plan wants the stop-loss carrier to just reimburse it, get it reimbursed. But the problem is the broker is not looking at next year. And next year, that plan is going to have a very hard time purchasing stop-loss, or if they're able to get stop-loss, I can't even imagine what their premium is going to be. You can't look. I learned from a person who I have a lot of respect for by the name of Mike Ferguson, who's the head of STIA, who told me many, many years ago, when I was literally new to the business, that you need to look at self-funding not as a one-year event, but has 3 to 5 years. You know if you're successful in self-funding by looking at a five-year window of what your overall costs are, not on any one-year plan. And I've taken that to heart in how we built this entire company. So what we realize is what brokers need to do is exactly what Mike told me to do years ago, is look at the big picture. You know what? Maybe the plan should care about the whole bill, because how are we going to renew? How are we going to purchase stop loss next year if we have all these huge, large spec claims that they didn't try to mitigate what the expenses were? So next, what do the providers actually care about? And here's something to really understand. What the providers care about is really simply one thing, and every person on this call knows this is true: not having to justify their charges. At the end of the day, I've been on thousands of cases where I've negotiated claim after claim after claim with facilities, cancer care centers, air ambulance centers, et cetera. And the one thing I realized is I've yet to have a phone call where I have a very knowledgeable discussion with the facility going over a bill and justifying each line item, like you would at a supermarket when you look at the bill and you go, hey, you billed this twice. And you go, you're right, I did. You take that off. All it is with them is, well, I'll give you a discount, or there's a network discount, or I can take 20% off if you pay this within a certain period of time. It's all based on just trying to make a deal versus ever looking at the actual charges in the first place. And why don't they have to justify their charges? It's really simple. Because the entities above, none of them agree as to what they actually care about in the first place. So as long as we don't all agree as to what the overall cost of Medicare should be and what the actual issues are, they're going to keep taking advantage of this. How do we change this dynamic? It's pretty simple. The way we change this dynamic is through transparency. But transparency is two things. Okay? Transparency is telling people that a bill is transparent versus actually seeing pricing online. And here's what I can tell you. When you look at the networks and what the contracts say, basically every network contract specifically spells out that if a provider actually tells people, their patients, their consumers, what the actual prices are, they're in violation of their network contracts. So although we have transparency built in the Obamacare model, the reality is in the marketplace, not in the regulatory place, not in the legal world, but in the marketplace itself, transparency doesn't exist at all when it comes to billing and what the patient actually sees. In our industry, people believe that transparency is when the patient sees their copay due is $25. That's not transparency. We need to change a whole model, and it's something with many, many people in our industry right now, many vendors in our industry are looking at. I'm seeing more and more plans and brokers really looking at changing this dynamic. And if you look at it, every other issue that Chris, John, and myself will be talking about today really tie into this whole idea of the fact that every entity, all the payers in our self-insured marketplace aren't on the same page as to what they actually care about when it comes to costs. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris to tie this all into subrogation and what we're seeing across the country right now. Chris?
So what are we seeing across the country in subrogation? And we're seeing it at the highest of stages. If someone had told me when I started at the FIA group and then, when I went to law school that I'd be at an organization whose one of our main business lines would be the topic of conversation at the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, this will be the fourth time since 1997. I'd say you were crazy. But that's what we're looking at. Since 1997, the Supreme Court of the United States has basically tackled the issue of subrogation and specifically the issue of equitable remedies four times. This is the fourth coming up now. But this one's really interesting, folks, because it has some they all have interesting implications, but this one's pretty wild. So SIA, along with NASS, some help from FIA and some other prominent lawyers in the country in subrogation, we all teamed up and we wrote an amicus brief. And sort of in preparation for today, I looked up who else has filed an amicus brief to the Supreme Court of the United States. And you will find, if you look that up, that the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons, has filed an amicus brief. Now, you might be thinking, this is a healthcare case. Why the heck is the AARP involved? Well, because remember, guys, ERISA is really about employee benefits generally. And one of the big areas of benefits that ERISA was intended to regulate was pensions. So it's not just about recovering money from the health plan. It's also about, hey, you know, your pension benefit paid you out too much, or your 401k paid you out too much. And during an audit 5 years from now, we uncover that, and now we're coming back after you. It's not just about recovering subrogation dollars. And that's important because the breadth of the case makes it dangerous, right? The Supreme Court of the United States might look at that and say, whoa, you know, we don't want plans being able to come back and sue plan participants for money they don't have anymore. But what are the implications of that? Let's look at it from a subrogation perspective. In 97, the Supreme Court in Knutson told us you cannot sue, you have to sue the party in possession of the funds. So Knutson has accepted a settlement and put the money in a trust, but the plan then sued Knutson. And the court said, you can't do that. You have to sue the trust. What happens if Knutson had taken that money and gambled it away or spent it, lost it all at the casino? If the court comes out on Mr. Montanil's side, the plaintiff in this case, the risk is that plan participants will now have a reason almost, certainly a motivation, to accept a settlement, take control of a settlement, and then get rid of it. And if this case comes out on Mr. Montanil's side, the plans will have a – it'll be virtually impossible to get the money after the fact, and it will really shift the burden to getting in on the front door. Now, let's talk about some statistics here for a second. For about 47% of cases get lawsuits, which means over half of the sort of settlements that occur never see a court, which means – We'll need to be able to know when people are actually filing claims. So we'll be relying on self-reporting, you know, maybe e-codes, but even e-codes to some extent, you need to have, you know, information, cooperation from the plan participant. If the court comes out pro Mr. Montanil in this case, they will effectively be saying it's perfectly okay for you to accept the settlement and get rid of the money. And that's a really dangerous proposition. What some estimates suggest that if subrogation reimbursement were not an option, plans and administrators could see an uptick in cost of 50%. That's wild, folks. Now, let's assume for a second they do come out pro-Montanil. What does that mean for all of us? That means we're going to be embroiled in a lot more lawsuits, a lot more lawyers, right? A lot more costs, a lot more trying to figure things out on the front end. The possible implications of this are very, very big. It just highlights sort of the importance of having experts involved from the beginning, having experts on your side, right? Because one of the big focuses of the brief was reminding the court, hey, listen, if you read the American Association of Justices brief, they tried to purport that only about 10% of employers self-fund, which anyone that's looked at the statistics at all in the past, I don't know, 7 to 10 to 20 years knows that's not accurate. We're actually closer to 65% at this rate. So it's a big deal. This decision will have huge implications on the health plan market. So really important. Another interesting piece of information, the Department of Justice has issued an amicus brief on this case, and they have issued an amicus brief in support of Mr. Montanil. Really interesting point there. We don't have any idea how it's going to come out, obviously. The court historically has been favorable to ERISA plans in this regard, and we do think that if the court stays true to its approach, sort of enforcing the terms of the plan as written, I think they're going to come out our way, but you never know how the court's going to come. And if you sort of look at the law the way they drafted it in Knutson, there's at least some concern that they might come out against the plan here. So we're going to keep watching that for you. If anyone want some information about the brief, you can certainly let us know. And additionally, this, again, just highlights the sort of the way that legislators and the American Association of Justice, the trial lawyers, are trying to impact your ability to self-fund because they can't directly impact your ability to self-fund. They're trying to do it indirectly. through subrogation, through stop loss, which we'll get into a little bit later.
Hey, Chris, can I, at the risk of being the brand new guy in the room and interrupting some of the most well-respected attorneys in the industry, I'm just going to go ahead and do that.
I'm not worthy. I am not worthy.
And if I can just make one quick comment, then we'll move on. One thing that a lot of people, you know, in the discussions like this don't talk about, but I think it's implied, but it's really good to mention out loud, is I think we feel good about where Montanil is going, but one thing that's really worth noting is, let's say it does go in a bad direction. Aside from saying it's impacting the plans, really, in the trickle-down effect, who's being impacted the most? Who's being impacted the worst? And that's going to be the member. Coming from a TPA background, as I was sitting and listening to Chris's discussion, one thing that struck me really, really importantly that I think will speak to everyone listening today is, if the Montanil decision comes out in a poor way, in our opinion, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot more holdout on claims.
Absolutely.
You're going to see a lot less pay and pursue. You know, right now I think a lot of people feel confident about a pay or pursue model, right or wrong, indifferent, whatever. A pay or pursue model, at least claims are getting paid up front. We feel confident in our sub row and reimbursement rights. Members' claims are getting paid. Now what they do with the money when they get reimbursed third party, that's part of what we're talking about today. But I would see you're going to see this trickle-down impact, and it would really harm the members because, again, right or wrong or indifferent, you will see plans say, we're not going to pay and pursue. We're going to find a reason to hold these claims. And ultimately, who's that hurt? The member. So I think you had a really amazing educational opportunity to help educate your members as to why a subrogation or reimbursement portion of the plan is actually good for the plan and good for the individual.
And that was another piece that was pushed very aggressively in that amicus brief, that the trickle-down effect of this is ultimately – plans are looking for ways to avoid that risk altogether, which will come in the form of benefit plan terms that say we don't pay when there's third parties involved, or we won't pay until we have all the information and confirm that all other funds are sort of no longer available. So, again, very important stuff to consider as this case comes.
Sure, and let's see for the impact that this could possibly have on stop loss and networks as well.
Right.
A divergence from the traditional pay-and-pursue model can just be hell for plans with PPOs or EPO networks. Right? I mean, if you're pending claims and finding a reason to not pay, well, then you're probably, or at least there's a good chance that you're going to miss your 30-day deadline, or even in some cases your 15-day deadline.
Or your advanced funding deadline.
Absolutely. With stop loss especially, there are a lot of policies out there that require that a claim be paid within a certain amount of time. If you're not paying and pursuing because you're not confident that you will be able to pursue, then you could bump up against some stop loss deadlines as well.
One more thing to add on to that, guys, as it relates to the subrogation process as a whole. Many TPAs obviously don't do the greatest job or take longer to actually get accident details or to find out about a subrogation case. Many times they find out about a case after it already settles. So this just puts more urgency on having the proper tools, technology, software to do whatever you can to identify the real subrogation opportunities, especially the ones that are worth some real money, in order to protect your rights in the long run. Because if not, you're obviously spending a lot of plan assets that otherwise would not have to be spent. So, John?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Adam. So we're going to move on now to the Self-Insurance Institute of America, then SIA, for all you newcomers to the industry. What's going on here? Basically, we've got a few states and the federal government doing some, unfavorable things right now. I'm not getting into too much detail on this, but Maryland, New York, and New Mexico, just to name a few, are coming out with some legislation that is very, very unfavorable to self-funding. And it's mostly not in the form of actually regulating self-funded groups, because as we know, there's this thing called ERISA preemption that some states don't even like to admit exists. But what these states are doing is setting regulations on stop-loss insurance. And as an example, New Mexico, as you'll see there, New Mexico is trying to define stop-loss as health insurance. I mean, as we in the industry know, not only is that ridiculous, but it's disruptive to the entire system as we exist within it. So that's New Mexico. New York State is regulating small group stop loss, as are a lot of other states. And Maryland is increasing minimum attachment points for stop loss, with an emphasis on small groups as well. And, you know, these are just some examples of efforts at the state level to really try to eradicate or severely limit self-funding. And there's also an issue in Connecticut, which we're going to touch on in a few slides.
And just remember, on the state level, John, one of the key things, you mentioned Connecticut, one of the key things that we're seeing on a state level is, why is it happening? So one thing is, yeah, this is what's happening. The thing we have to all think about is, why is it happening? So why are these states trying to put the squeeze on the stop-loss market? And it's a really simple answer. The more they can squeeze out stop-loss, that means there's less availability for a smaller employer or even a middle-sized employer to actually self-fund. So we're self-funded here at FIA. If we did not have the opportunity to purchase stop-loss at a reasonable low level, we could not be self-funded, meaning we would have to either A, join the exchange, or B, be fully insured. If we were in the exchange, the state would control us because we have an exchange here in Massachusetts, or we'd be fully insured, and then again, the state insurance commissioner would control our plan and our premiums and everything that relates to healthcare, which is what they're trying to do. So the reason why they're trying to hurt or limit availability of stop loss is to push more plans, more employers, away from self-funding and into the fully insured and exchange models. That's sure. Why it's happening. A great explanation of what is happening.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. So, yeah, I mentioned ERISA preemption not so long ago, and I'm just going to make an analogy here. It's like if a person comes into your house, but you are unable to regulate what that person does in your house. That's how states look at so-called ERISA plans. They're operating within the state, but the state realistically has no control over them, and that's what states are trying to change. So how you can help, right? SIA is not just complaining about its problems. SIA is a great tool that we all have for really combating these injustices to the industry. And SIA is making a push for us all to write letters and make calls and attend hearings. I mean, we like to talk about legislators as not really caring about the little guy. But when a lot of little guys get together, you've got a big guy. And so, the more outreach they get, the more support that these laws have against them, the more the legislatures are going to have no choice but to listen, especially coming from employers and larger employers especially. So, high-level representatives of the plan sponsor are the ideal candidates to call up your senators and your state representatives and tell them that you are unhappy and why you're unhappy and why this does not make sense for you.
And often it's that the legislators, they don't even really understand what's going on. And so part of it is educating them and also reminding them, hey, 65% of your employee population is covered by these plans. You need to pay attention to the impact this will have on them.
Sure. So there is a relatively new law called Protecting Affordable Coverage for Employees Act. The acronym there is PACE. So this is a law that has recently passed the House and Senate, and it's currently waiting for the president to sign it. So technically it's not law yet, but it's as good as law. And what this does is a little interesting. It gives states the option to define the small group market as 2 to 100 or 2 to 50, and it's completely up to the states. Now, in states looking to limit or eliminate stop-loss in the small group market, they're obviously going to consider the small group to be as broad as possible. And in states that either, have not spoken up against stop-loss or that just don't really mind, well, they may still decide that the broader category for any number of reasons. But what we're hoping is that states who are passing legislation to regulate stop-loss will consider the small group market 2 to 50 if it has any impact on self-funded plans. Some states
as
do.
As you guys know on the call, these groups, what we're noticing is most of our TPA clients are growing, some of them growing rapidly, and where we're seeing the growth is this under 100 life market. I would say the sweet spot's around 75 to 80. So obviously this is a big deal for many of our clients across the country because those 80 life groups basically potentially could not be self-funded any longer and you would lose that business. So again, something you need to keep an eye out, just especially based on where we're seeing the growth patterns in self-funding coming from.
Sure. So as many of you know, Hillary Clinton is a burgeoning force in the political arena and she has...
Burgeoning?
I describe her as still burgeoning, sure. So she has proposed her own brand of healthcare reform. And, you know, obviously we've got the ACA and Obamacare, and it's got its problems, it's got its strengths. Regardless of your feelings, hear me out on Hillary's plan. There's a quote that was in the New York Times that's really interesting and a great description of this. But basically, Hillary Clinton is looking for more accountability in pricing, which is something that we have really not seen in recent memory. The ACA is focused on the protection of patients, of course, but not the protection of the insurance companies or self-funded employers. I mean, when legislators think of insurance, they think of the BUCAs, they think of the big players with almost unlimited amounts of money. They don't think of self-funded employers who are consistently taken advantage of by ASCs and hospitals. And, you know, negotiation attempts are really, the providers really don't differentiate between insurance companies and self-funded plans. And that's really unfortunate for the market at large. So one problem that I personally have with Hillary Clinton's proposed plan is that it lumps together insurers and drug manufacturers and essentially imposes fault onto both indiscriminately. And, you know, there's probably something to be said for insurers, and I use that word in the strictest sense, for actual, you know, the BUCAs, the big insurers, having some sort of responsibility for the price to the member. But drug manufacturers are certainly not to be lumped in with self-funded plans. In a sense, they're polar opposites when it comes to setting costs versus offsetting costs. What we need and, you know, what we really haven't gotten any, unfortunately, is the cost of care. And, you know, this goes back to what Adam was talking about before. Everybody focuses on the cost of insurance, but the cost of care is what primarily drives the cost of insurance. So why not cut out the middleman and go for the providers and regulate what they are charging? Well, why not? That's a great question. Hillary claims that she is attempting to spearhead that, but you know, it remains to be seen whether this even goes anywhere. So I mentioned that we were going to get into Connecticut a little bit. So here's that. Basically, we've got bulletin HC 103, and we've talked about it, I think, in our last webinar, and we gave a kind of high-level overview, but we've gotten some developments and actually some special thanks to our friends over at Diversified Administration Corporation and Diversified Group Brokerage. Basically, HC 103 aims to get rid of lasers and, to some degree, hard gaps between a stop-loss policy and the plan that it insures. And in theory, this sounds great, right? I mean, we always advise plans that having gaps is a negative thing, and we perform our gap-free analysis to advise you where the gaps are. But not allowing the insurers to have any gaps or lasers, that's problematic because of premium rates. If stop-loss carriers are unable to give lasers and are unable to not mirror the plan document, they will have no choice but to charge an arm and a leg because the underwriting process is going to go haywire. And stop-loss carriers, I mean, for a long time, they're probably just not going to know how to quote these groups and how to do this without lasers, and they are going to err on the side of caution, which is understandable, and the quotes are going to be raised by up to 20% by some estimates. And according to the Department of Insurance in Connecticut, employers are not prepared employers are not prepared to navigate stop-loss. Whether that is true or not, is it correct that the DOI should go in and, you know, not let stop-loss do what it needs to do? I don't think so. Apparently the Department of Insurance does. It remains to be seen how this really plays out in Connecticut. So moving away from the kind of...
Really quick in regards to Connecticut.
Yeah.
This is a great example, and again, I know there's a big kudos up there to Brooks Goodison and Charlie Solo at Diversified for their great work in this regard, and they've really led the charge as it relates to Connecticut and really protecting the rest of the country. So if I'm a TPA or a self-funded plan on this call, you know, a shout-out to Diversified, I think, is well needed as in respect to what they've done in the state of Connecticut. But this is a great example of how having individuals within our own industry push back on a state level can really make a difference. And what they've done, I mean, I can't even imagine what the state of Connecticut would look like today if it wasn't for Brooks and his team's leadership as it relates to really going to the commissioner of the state and pushing back in regards to all the changes they wanted done. So I just want to make sure we give her proper kudos to that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Adam. So we're going to move away now from the regulatory and legal updates and talk about some industry trends. And the title says Troubling Trends. This first one is actually going to be not so troubling. This first one is going to be kind of a high mark on our list of trends. And this is regard to reference-based pricing. A recent case, Romano Wood Dialysis Center versus Admiral Linen Service. This is a case that really shows a great success that reference-based pricing has had. And we've seen a lot of failures. We've seen a few successes. This is one of the major ones. And this is an instance where a court really came out and said, yes, what you're doing is okay. And, you know, I should really qualify that. I'm certainly not saying that the court said, as a blanket statement, reference-based pricing is fine. That is not what happened. What happened here is there was a dialysis claim incurred, and plan language that the FIA group actually helped draft, plan language was very, very clear that the provider would not be paid more than 125% of the Medicare allowable fee schedule amount. Now, it's very important, and we always stress that plan language is of the utmost importance. But this case really focused on how clear and bulletproof the plan language was, and that's just so important. And, you know, the Medicare Secondary Payer Act prohibited balance billing because this member was enrolled in Medicare through dialysis. This was during the coordination period. And there was no conflicting network agreement in play. And it's as important as the plan language. I cannot stress enough that if there's a network contract that regulates how much you have to pay, there is going to be a problem every time.
Reference-based pricing. I think it's pretty funny you said that, John, because I know that you just put something on LinkedIn where you made that little factoid that, you know, what you have in a plan doc, if something else contradicts a network agreement, it doesn't mean that the plan document overrides. It's almost the opposite, especially on a state level. So that's very important for people to know. Regardless of what you have in your plan doc, at the good first start, you need to make sure there's nothing else out there, no other agreement, whether it's a contract, direct contract agreement with the facility, or a network agreement that contradicts that language. You need to know that it's out there.
And this is Tim jumping in really quickly. Just to add, I just want to add and really emphasize that what John just said and what Adam just said is exactly correct, not just from a high-level conversation standpoint like we're having today, but I've seen it in my years at a TPA. I saw this exact concept occur, but in the opposite, where you have good plan language, very good plan language regarding percentage of Medicare payments and for dialysis claims, for example, but conflicting network contract wins every time, folks. So not just at a high-level conversation, but in the real world, this happens, absolutely.
Yeah.
So very important.
Right. So this case, like I said, it represents a huge victory for this plan and for all plans dealing in a similar universe. But like I said, all the stars need to align. There's no, you know, blanket reference-based pricing is fine, you're going to win every time. Absolutely not the case. But when there's nothing kind of holding the plan back, when the language is good, when there's no network language conflicting, that's when reference-based pricing really works its magic. Something else that we've been seeing in the industry, and now we're going to get more into the troubling trends region, and we're going to move away from that high point, is regarding the hiring of clinical auditors. And this applies to stop loss just as much as applies to a plan, because they both have occasion to employ code editors and clinical auditors and all sorts of repricing vendors. The case study here is that, in a nutshell, the plan defined usual and customary as the prevailing charge in the area. But it went on to hire a clinical auditor, which performed all sorts of code edits and clinical findings that were not identified within the plan document. The provider appealed and said, you know, you've already shown me your plan document, and I don't see your right to do this anywhere in it. Can you explain to me what's going on? And this is actually, interestingly and rarely, this was a provider that was prepared to accept the plan's payment as long as the plan paid what the plan said it was going to pay. But because the plan could not justify what it did, the provider said, well, you know, then you have to pay me the prevailing charge in the area. As we know, the prevailing charge in the area is usually it somehow always works out to what that provider charges, right? I mean, it's no coincidence. But really, the providers are tailoring their charges based on essentially what other area providers charge. And there are always specialty providers, and I'm not going to name any names, but there are always some that charge more exorbitantly than everybody else. But the default is exorbitant. So applying, you know, the traditional notion of UNC as the prevailing charge in the area, that's just deadly for a plan. I mean, for one thing, you're not able to reduce your reimbursement. And for another thing, the plan document just doesn't support it. So even if you hire an auditor, technically, you're not permitted to use that auditor's criteria. So not only are you wasting money on the auditor, you're wasting money on the claim.
Folks on the call, when you have vendors out there who are willing to negotiate your claims or are willing to audit your claims, and they're getting paid on a percentage of savings, and they're not asking you for a copy of your plan document first, don't work with them. It's as simple as that. If they don't care about what your plan language says in regards to how a claim should be paid, they shouldn't be negotiating or auditing your claim. Blank statement right off the bat. If that's not the first thing they ask for, find another vendor to utilize. Chris?
Thanks, Adam. Claims data. It's a very broad concept that applies to almost everything related to self-funding. And this is an issue that if everything works out the way we hope it does, we're going to start seeing a lot more of, right? So groups that have traditionally been fully insured coming over to the self-funded space, are they going to an ASO? Are they going to a traditional self-funding, sort of a TPA model? Or are they going to an ASO and then going to a traditional TPA model? All of those things, you really have the same problem is who owns that data? And isn't that probably the biggest benefit to sort of being traditionally self-funded through the TPA, your access to that data, and most importantly, your ability to cater benefits because of that data? As I was preparing for the webinar today, I kept thinking to myself, as we see more and more sort of the fiduciary lawsuits, brokers and TPAs being sued for the advice they gave or didn't give, will a broker's ability or inability to sort of very clearly differentiate between an ASO and a TPA sort of start to bite some brokers and TPAs in the rear end when the plan finds out, wait, we could have saved XYZ, but we didn't because my broker or my advisor didn't suggest it or didn't explain it well enough. Obviously a big component. And look, guys, data is the key, right? You get to decide, you know, you get to see where your pain points are. You know, are your pain points dialysis? Are your pain points, I don't know, heart conditions? Do you, you know, is your entire staff overweight? What wellness programs? All of this stuff hinges on data. And so if you as a plan can't see it, and all you see is here's your gold plan, here's your silver plan, here's your bronze plan, and we're just going to use your money, which means we really have no invested interest in saving your money, that's a big piece. And so understanding the difference, you know, the sales teams, forces that are going out there, brokers, really understanding the difference between those two models and the importance of that data is so, 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 so key.
So with that, we're going to talk about overpayments really quick and some recent cases that have come up. But I want to make sure I touch base in regards to what Chris brought up. If I'm a TPA and I have salespeople, the number one thing I'm focusing on is this access to data, because by having access to data, you are then able to customize the plan document, which is the second biggest piece. So those are the two areas where a TPA potentially could have a competitive advantage over the ASO and fully insured models. Speaking of overpayments, what we have seen recently, especially in light of the prompt pay laws, is this particular situation where you have an overpayment because a plan, a TPA, is trying to get a claim processed in a timely fashion in order to secure a valuable needed discount on behalf of their plan and to secure stop-loss reimbursements as well from a timing standpoint, whether it's advanced funding, et cetera. And what we see is when a claim is overpaid, meaning they paid the claim, maybe it shouldn't have been paid, they found out additional information after the fact that the claim was not payable, that could happen. And what we've seen is many situations, a TPA attempting to pursue the overpayment, but really not pushing too hard because they're concerned that it's a mistake. They've made a mistake. They don't want to glorify the mistake. They don't want their client to know about it. So if they're not getting responses back to these particular overpayments or getting the funds back, they sort of just put that file away in a drawer somewhere, hoping never to have to look at it again. What we're seeing is more and more plans, whether it's the plan themselves who are more educated or the brokers that are representing these plans having more, I would say, involvement in the particular claims, is we've seen a lot more pushback and potential lawsuits filed by these employers against their administrators for not either A, for overpaying, but more than likely for not pursuing the actual overpayment in the first place. So this is something that I would urge many of you out there, if you have a situation like this, we always, even though we do overpayment recovery here at FIA, we always urge our clients to try to get that money back first on your own. We can even help you to ensure that your process in securing these reimbursements is the right process to have. It's an efficient process. It makes sense legally. It's tied into your plan design and what your language says. But if you need the big guns to be pulled out, we're obviously available there to assist you if need be. But this is a major, we're just seeing a big influx in these types of requests, inquiries, et cetera, from plans and brokers wondering or advising, trying to get information as to why a payment was made or why an overpayment was not recouped. So, Chris, can we turn it over to you?
Thanks, Adam. And we're starting to come up on time. So, I mean, just, folks, other things that are certainly very pertinent, the Department of Labor is basically going out there and auditing. So, you know, be careful what it is you're advising your clients to do. Be careful what, you know, the kinds of programs you're offering, and make sure they are, you know, on the up and up with the law. I mean, this is one we've seen before. TPAs, my apologies. I was off on a completely different slide. Fiduciary duty. Are you the fiduciary? You disclaim it, but does that mean you're not the fiduciary? And as we know, that is absolutely not the case. If you walk like a fiduciary and you talk like a fiduciary, guess what? You might be a fiduciary. Or the duck, as John so adequately placed it last week. And so it's really important that you sort of understand what are your liabilities? What risks are you taking when you interpret the terms of the plan? I know we all say that, well, I'm following the terms of the plan document. But are you honestly saying that you have never, ever looked at a sort of a fence, an on-the-fence issue, and made a call one way or the other? Because if you did, the court would probably say you're a fiduciary. And if you're making those kinds of decisions, or you are, you know, dealing with a plan who's afraid to make those kinds of decisions, you have to be ready to assist and see what's out there in order to help them sort of work through those difficulties of becoming self-funded.
Hey, Chris, if I could chime in for a second in regards to this, folks, it's really simple. Take a look at your ASA. Your ASA says that your ASA probably says that you're not a fiduciary under any circumstance. Now what I ask you to do is have some type of assistant or someone in your office take a look at all of your template letters as it relates to claims. If those letters do not say the following, then you need to change it. Your letter should state XYZ TPA on behalf of XYZ employee benefit plan. If your letters regarding claims don't reference the plan in the template format, change it. Because if your letters say that XYZ TPA has received a claim or is denying a claim, anything that references that you are making the decision, and not the employer, you need to change those now. It's easy. It's much easier. Trust me, we get it. We have a lot of customization here at Donatia. I get why you want to just write your name. You don't have to every time merge in the field the employer's name. But if you don't do that, it can be looked upon by a judge and by all the parties that you are making decisions and not the particular plan. So it's really important that that is done. It's something you can easily do. It'll take you 15 minutes. So check it out. Speaking of risk shifting, Chris, you want to get on that?
Yeah, right. Get on that again.
Look, a lot of these, if you can't laugh at yourself, right? A lot of these things tie together, right? This concept of risk shifting, we just talked about it, the DOL audits. The DOL is auditing, especially on the tail end of the ACA. You're seeing it a lot more. And sort of, you know, TPAs, brokers, vendors that are out there sort of pushing some strategies that maybe are on, you know, towing the line. You have to be careful, because if you're not paying attention, you're going to over push that line, or you're going to make a judgment call that maybe shouldn't have been made, and all of a sudden you've got DOL problems, you've got, you know, whatever ramifications come with being sort of in breach of DOL regulations. And I mean, then you've got all kinds of, again, fiduciary obligations and fiduciary duties that come with making those kinds of errors, thereby exposing the plan to additional costs. I mean, we see it sometimes with employers trying to, you know, shift patients onto Medicare, or, you know, forcing patients onto the exchange in some capacity, you know, still offering a plan, but trying to find a way to carve out high-risk employees and send them to the exchange. These are all things that, as the exchanges start to either do really well or fail, and Adam always says, we kind of need them to do sort of okay, these are the kind of things that the state regulators, the Department of Labor, are going to come after us. Why? Because we're the ones that are out there trying to, you know, trying to rock the boat a little bit, be innovative. So be careful with some of the programs you are trying to utilize, which brings us right to the next slide, and make sure that you are sort of in line with the law, that the programs you're utilizing actually provide and you can execute on the promises you're making, and that you are totally in line with, oh, by the way, not just the ACA, right? ERISA, HIPAA, you know, healthcare is such a broad area, and as we've all known, there are so many different humongous laws that come into play. COBRA, it's insane how many large laws sort of we have to contend with every day, and so it's really important that you are aware of sort of the compliance issues, that you're on top of those compliance issues, and that you have the experts in hand that you need when those issues come to light.
All right, and prompt payment is an issue that we have all fallen victim to, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this because it speaks for itself, and like I said, we've all experienced it. Companies like MedAssets and the Schumacher Group, and many of you may already be disconnecting just from hearing those names, but we see issues all the time of what's a clean claim? How does the plan define a clean claim? Well, inevitably, it's going to be different from how the network contract defines a clean claim. There are going to be problems, and especially we were talking before about paying and pursuing. When the network contract says a clean claim is any claim you receive, well, that's not very helpful, but that's what the contract says. And the plan document is going to say a claim is clean only when you receive all the necessary information and when the TPA has everything it needs to properly adjudicate. Well, guess what? The network doesn't care. Nor do MedAssets or the Schumacher Group.
That definition of clean sounds pretty dirty to me, John.
Yeah, no kidding. And good one. So there's also the issue of stop loss with prompt pay, and untimely payments can result in stop loss denials, or at least, you know, the carriers and MGUs really looking into claims and saying, why did you do what you did here? Why did you not just pay the claim? And the answer is because claims are not always considered clean in the same way by the same individuals. Just as networks sometimes have kind of unreasonable definitions for what is a clean claim, sometimes stop-loss carriers and MGUs have definitions of when a claim is paid that does not align with the plan document. And lastly, before we go today, I'm going to talk briefly about plan language. And I mentioned before how utterly important it really is. But a lot of what we see is TPAs and groups coming to us and saying, we're interested in implementing this new program. Can you review this contract for us? We're going to get started next week. And we say, well, we'll hold on. We can definitely review the contract for you, but your plan doesn't allow you to do this. In addition to reviewing the contract, we're more than happy to work with you to formulate plan language to implement this. But without the plan language, programs that plans are going to do to contain costs and shift risk and all sorts of other things, they just won't work. It's as if you wanted to pay based on 200% of Medicare, but you just didn't include it in the plan. What's your authority to do that? Simple answer, you don't have any. Plan language is just so important to all of the cost containment efforts that a plan and TPA can possibly do. It cannot be ignored. And we at the FIA Group, we draft plan language for all occasions. We customize it to fit your needs. If you are looking into a new program to save your plan money, please, we urge you, have the plan language looked at. If not by us, by someone else, but by us. And with that, I'll turn it back to Adam, and we're going to say thank you.
Guys, thank you very much. I appreciate the hundreds of people that have been on this call. A couple of things I want people to be aware of. These webinars are now set up on a podcast. You see it at thefiagroup.podomatic.com. Our next webinar will be on Wednesday, November 18th. I want to make sure I thank John, Chris, and also Tim for the great insight they had on this particular webinar. I think folks who don't know Tim, I think you'll realize he's going to fit right in here at FIA with his expertise within this industry. In addition, there's a reason we brought Tim aboard. We are coming out with a brand new big-time service. It's going to be announced this weekend in Ernie Clevenger's webinars, Ernie Clevenger's newsletter. So please, on Saturday night when you're having a few drinks at midnight, I'm sure you'll receive his email. You'll see our new service there, which we will be showcasing at SIA next week. And the reason why we brought Tim aboard is to lead that charge in regards to this new and very innovative and very different service that we are offering to the self-insured industry as a whole. So on behalf of John, Tim, Ron, who's right now changing a diaper, Chris as well, thank you for dialing in today. We appreciate it very much, and we will see you a month from now. Thank you, and have a great day.
Thank you.